7611. And on Sunday, April 22nd at 1 p.m., the organization Revolting Lesbians will hold an Earth Day protest they're calling The Earth Is Not For Sale at the Museum of Natural History on West 77th Street and Central Park West in Manhattan to protest the presence of major Republican donor and co-owner of Breitbart News, Rebecca Mercer, on the museum's board. Rebecca Mercer has bought her way into the White House and onto the Board of Trustees at the Museum of Natural History. Reads a statement from organizers. Mercer money is destroying our democracy and our planet. Nobody voted for her, and she has no place on the board of a science museum. We will continue to revolt against Rebecca Mercer's position on the board until she is removed or resigns. To learn more, go to justiceduckling.com and click on the NYC protest events calendar at the top of the page, or you can email the organizers directly at revoltinglesbians@gmail.com. Also happening on that same date and time, Earth Day Sunday, April 22nd at 1 p.m., over 40 community organizations from Westchester will come together at Pace Law School at 78 North Broadway in White Plains, New York, for the Westchester Social Forum. We live in a time of struggle as we witness growing threats to the well-being of our planet and communities as profit is placed over people and land and corporations, not civilians, control our democracy, reads a statement from organizers. Yet we the people have the collective power to organize a movement for change. Find out more at westchestersocialforum.org, or you can reach Pace Law School directly by calling 914-422-4210. And on Saturday, April 28th at 2 p.m., the May Day Collective is presenting a free outdoor concert in Maria Hernandez Park at 301 Soydom Street in Brooklyn called the May Day Festival of Resistance. Scheduled performers include Nitty Scott, Maku Sound System, and Bushwick Jorico Collective. This year, we lift up the fierce, powerful movements led by women of color, black women, trans women, and femmes who are transforming our world, reads a statement from the May Day Collective about the event. Women around the country and world are fighting patriarchy, working to end community militarization, transforming the political dialogue, challenging the mainstream entertainment industry, and creating global culture through unapologetic intersectional feminism. To get more information about the May Day Festival of Resistance, go to facebook.com/maydayspace and click on events at the side of the page, or send an email to info@maydayspace.com.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This week represents the 50th anniversary of the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey. Joining me will be Dan Persons. Stay tuned. Thank you. once again, good morning. So, there's a lot to talk about. I have been thinking about, how to deal with the opening, commemorating this for actually more than a year. But I haven't come up with anything particularly special. My number one resource for this would have been, of course, the doc, Paul Wunder. But Paul is, not on somewhere in that astral plane, as is seen in the movie 2001. But he is the single person that I know who I would call absolutely, utterly expert. Now, of course, there's also our movie critic, Dan Persons, who is in Philly and seems to be having Skype problems. Let me try to bring up his sound. Are you there at all, Dan? Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, Dave. I can't comply.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you're sounding pretty good there.
Yeah, you're sounding okay, too. I was panicking here because during the theme you were cutting in and out, but okay. Sounds okay now.
Okay, yeah, do me a favor. When I'm engineering and trying to set up and log in to Facebook and Google and stuff like that, which is everything I have to do during my theme music alone, bear in mind that's what I'm doing at that moment. So it's...
I'm just a little pest, that's all.
Yeah, pest? Sorry, never mind. so anyway, there are so many places to start, and I'm still not logged into Google, which if I'm going to play any of the music that I wish to play, I'm going to have to do. So just bear with me a moment. But I think that... I am going to start with a statement that for very few people may be slightly incendiary, and I'm going to expect you, Dan, to defend that statement because I don't believe you're going to attack it. And okay. The statement is that 2001, A Space Odyssey, is plain and simple the best science fiction film ever made.
Well, if you wanted an opposing opinion, no, you're not going to get it here. I would agree completely with that. I wanted to point out that it's interesting the way you started in on this conversation because for the past month or so, I myself have been figuring out what I wanted to say during this show and actually have come a cropper myself in trying to form my opinions. And I think the reason for me, and this cues into our shared opinion that this is the greatest science fiction film ever made, was that at the very least for me, this was more than a film. I think people tend to use, and I tend to use, like the phrase, this was a formative event for me. People use that too often. But in this particular case, it is quite true that this goes beyond just being a film. This is something that I saw at a time of life that changed the way I looked at many things, looking at film, looking at science fiction, looking at storytelling. And so
I may point out that it is I'm having problems logging in. I'm going to forget Facebook. I'm into Google. That's good enough. It is a unique film. There was never a film like it before. And while some movies have emulated it or tried to do certain things on it, or many, many refer to it, there has never been an equal.
in many, many ways. Now, I
will say one thing. There are those people that will say, and I can name some of them. For example, they think Blade Runner is better, to which I say rubbish because I don't even think Blade Runner is that brilliant a film on its own. I prefer the sequel. But the sequel was better thought out, and they knew that they had to live up to a certain something, and I think that Denis Villeneuve is a better director than Ridley Scott. Period.
I wouldn't necessarily argue with that, but you know I had problems with 2049.
Well, there are some issues. There are some problems. It is not a perfect movie. For that matter, 2001 is not a perfect movie, but it still set a mark. But my point about Blade Runner versus 2001 is that I will put dollars to donuts that the people who will say otherwise saw those movies at a certain age. That is to say, I saw 2001 in Cinerama at age 13 at least three times. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, then, when it was re-released in 70 millimeter, a lot of people rediscover it, and that was, you know, it was a bomb at first. It did not do well, and after all, there aren't Cinerama theaters in every major place. The 70 millimeter was getting around, and when it was re-released, what, about 1971 or something like that?
I think it was 73 or 74.
73 was the first number that came into my head, so probably is that. And then they called it the Ultimate Trip.
Yeah.
They were going for the psychedelia rather than for what it was about.
Well, I think the coinage of the phrase "the ultimate trip" came in during the initial release. The way I heard the tale was that the film was bombing. There was some theater manager who one day went into the theater. The theater was empty, except there was a hippie sitting in the front row. And then the next day, the hippie was back, and he had brought two friends with him.
I can tell you about eight reasons why that's not true.
Okay.
Number one, it would have to be in a Cinerama theater.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Cinerama theaters are big, and they don't do screenings without, you know, big. So it's not like it was, what it was is it wasn't making its money back, partly also because Kubrick went over budget and over time. But number two, it was never on a poster saying the ultimate experience until years later. And believe me, that's not because some member of NATO, and that would be the National Association of Theater Owners, came up with it. It was the marketing people, and they came up with it. And those posters are very valuable. And that's the first time it was coined that, years after the movie debuted.
Okay, that may be true. I am,
and I've one advantage over you. I lived through it.
Oh, I lived through. Well,
yeah, no, you were.
Wait,
when youngster,
you say it,
Dan.
It depends what it means. What is it for you? Because I lived through it too. Let me give you the perspective.
How old were you when the movie debuted in 1968?
Well, okay, I came into it slightly after the fact. You know, you had shared with me an article by Stuart Klawan or Claywan.
Yeah, I threw a whole slew of articles at
you.
And
one of the interesting things that he pointed out, because let me explain how I came to it. And go if the detail gets a little tedious, cut me off at the knees. But for one thing, I think he can agree that 1968 was a crappy year. Just altogether. I mean, there were assassinations, There was there's a lot of bad stuff going on, and of course it ended up with Nixon. But on top of that, from a more personal level, in the spring of 1968, I was hospitalized with an ulcer. And while I was in the hospital, I had gotten my hands on a Life magazine that had a photo spread on 2001. And there were several quotes in that. I mean, I was looking at the photographs and they were showing the stills of, I believe the among them were the stills of the TMA one or the set, the TMA one. And a photo of Bowman in the Hal Memory Bank. But there were also quotes, and I think there was a quote by Arthur C. Clarke in there saying that one of the directives from Kubrick was that he didn't want to do Lost in Space or Star Trek. And I was a big Star Trek fan at that point, and I said, well, that's awfully presumptuous of them.
I'll just say, and we'll get into this in a while, my version and memory of events of what went on are very, very, very different than those of Sir Arthur. I've historians who are alive and with us to back that up, but we'll get into that later.
Okay.
However, what you said was non-controversial. I just thought I'd throw that in to keep people guessing. And oh, by the way, I've had my big trivia question. I know I've told this to you, and I will send it out via voice to people listening, which is... many people think that Kubrick based his movie on a short story by Arthur C. Clarke called The Sentinel. I will tell you, he did not. The Sentinel had a lot to do with the movie. It had a lot to do with what ended up happening. But Kubrick's original vision did, in fact, begin because of his reading of a short story. It was not a story even written in English. And if anybody wants to guess what that is, oh, I guess what you can do is email me, jim@ourwolf.com. I can get into my email, if not Facebook.
It was actually Wasp Women of Mars.
That was the one.
A you thrilling got first tale guess. From Gee Whiz Wonderful Science Fiction Stories. I remember that one.
Yeah.
Okay,
but in the Portuguese edition, no doubt, because it was
in
not...
In the original Portuguese. You should only read it in the original Portuguese because the English translation loses a lot of the nuance.
Yeah, and actually, I threatened to read this story on the air this morning, and aside from the fact that it would take about 40 to 45 minutes to read the whole thing... and WBAI had somewhere, and I had a copy of the great Mike Hodel reading this story. I think Baird Searles would have produced it. I saw the names in there. I saw the words. They are Hispanic words, and I would bungle the pronunciations, and I think it's better to not pronounce. We will tell people where to read the story. It's available for free online. But people email me, jim@ourwolf.com, with your guesses. Okay, sorry, go on.
Okay, so in any case, but I had read this article, but I come out of the hospital, and I think right around the time I came out of the hospital, Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Yeah.
So it was right around this time.
And how old were you?
I was 12 years old.
Oh, okay. So you're younger than me then. Okay.
Yeah, 1 year younger.
I thought you were more junior. Okay.
Yeah. No, getting an ulcer at 12 years is not exactly the most brilliant thing anyway. But because of that, because of Martin Luther King and a lot of what was going on, I was feeling quite vulnerable in the world, on top of the fact that puberty came rather early for me and rather unannounced. So I didn't know what the bleep was going on at that point in my life. But here again, the film opened in April. I didn't get to it until apparently, and here was my point about what Mr.
So you saw it in Klawan's first run. Okay. So you did see it in first
run.
Well,
here's the thing, is that Klawan's talks about the fact that it was projected in 70 millimeter in the Roadshow version, and just to explain quick what a Roadshow version is that there used to be these things called Roadshow versions of films, which came with an overture and an intermission and an entr'acte, which is the music that plays before the film actually begins after the intermission. And you would actually get reserved seats in the theater, which is what they did
at the Cinerama, which was
exactly,
yeah,
exactly. And so when we're talking about event movies, this is what made the movie an event movie. It was more like going to an actual theatrical presentation.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely correct. And I may just toss in that all Cinerama movies had reserved seats and were these big, big events.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the thing that
Let's explain, by the way, what Cinerama is. Or I won't say was, because there is a place where one can still see Cinerama, and I'll tell that story shortly. It involves the aforementioned Paul Wonder. But Cinerama was basically a triptych of screens. It was a curved screen. What degree would you say it was? Like 120 degrees?
I think it was something like 135. It was like 135 degree arc. It was a pretty deep arc.
Yeah, yeah. And if you had the right position, mm-hmm. and according to Paul Wonder, and I find this still to be true, the perfect seat for any movie is one screen length away. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you're watching a movie on a 50-foot screen, sit 50 feet back. Mm-hmm. And that's, for some reason, that's just enough to cover up to your peripheral vision without going into your peripheral vision. Therefore, you see all the action on the screen. Your eyeballs do move, keeping you engaged with the film, but you don't have to turn your head. Mm-hmm.
The original Cinerama was a triptych. In other words, it was three projectors aimed at this one arced screen and was shot with three cameras. By the time we got to 2001, they had abandoned Mm-mm. that technique. It was
not true.
No, yes, definitely yes. It was filmed in Super Panavision.
Shall I tell you my story now?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the WBAI Cinema Club, as run by Paul Wonder, where I did The Door, we mm-hmm. did a screening of 2001 in Cinerama, probably about, 18 years ago. They couldn't find, MGM did not have a copy. We were using the MGM screening room. That is where we held the cinema club by coincidence every month. Mm-hmm. So Paul, who had his connections, and one of them was named Stanley, nobody called him Stanley, it was Mr. Kubrick. Paul contacted Mr. Kubrick's office, and we had Mr. Kubrick's copy in three film cans. We had three projectors, and the people at the MGM screening room were ape bleep over the fact that they could finally screen something in bona fide original Cinerama. I watched them thread the projectors. This is not secondhand. This is firsthand. And the thing about that, the sad thing about that is we didn't have time to test the system. They were able to sync the projectors and get the whole thing ready, and then the people came in for the movie, donating to BAI on the way in, of course, and the movie started. Also, Sprach Zarathustra begins, the strains of the music begin, and all of the black in the print had turned to magenta. In order to save some measly $10,000 or something, instead of using whatever coloring process, you would know this better than I, they used
Technicolor. The Technicolor dye transfer process, which was a more stable process.
And this was from Kodak.
Eastman color. Probably.
Okay, yes. Instead of using Eastman color.
No, they would have been using Eastman color instead of the Technicolor dye transfer
process. What they used was called MGM color.
Yeah, Eastman color went under a number of house brands.
It may have been an OEM'd original equipment manufacturer thing, but because it wasn't the proper thing, over the years, the black had faded and turned into magenta. And let me tell you something. This is evident from, well, let me tell the audience something. This is evident from the very first shots in the movie. There is a great deal of black in that movie.
Yeah.
And Paul, who had quit substance problems that he had had sometime before that, came out of the screening room and he was so depressed. I opened the door, looked in and saw what the problem was, and he went out and I thought, oh God, he's going to score. He's going to do something really bad. And what he did was he got himself three shots of espresso and he just downed them one after another. He looked at me and said, mild buzz. So the story isn't actually so much about those, but I saw the film cans and I saw the projectors, and that was Mr. Kubrick's copy. There were only three in existence.
That may well be. I am not the reason I take issue with that is that if you watch an actual three camera Cinerama film, one of the things that you'll notice a lot in those films is that equidistant in a lot of shots will be some sort of vertical object.
Yes. In a lot of them, in order to disguise the fact that there was this sort of like seam down
the edge of the frame, in order to conceal the edge of the frame from each of the panels. There isn't a lot. I'm going to say that there isn't a lot of that in 2001. I would go out on a limb and say there isn't anything like that in 2001.
There was some. I remember especially like the scene on the moon when they first encounter the monolith in the year 2001. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was evident.
I mean you saw what you saw. I don't argue with you about that. I'm wondering if possibly given that you saw it in the New York Cinerama Theater, which was equipped for three projector.
Yeah.
Cinerama, whether Kubrick had shot it in there were two formats. One was Super Panavision, one was Ultra Panavision, and I think the one that they used for one projector, Cinerama, was Super Panavision. Mm-hmm. So it may be that he shot it in Super Panavision, and then they, for want of a better term, remastered it into three projector Cinerama for theaters like the New York Theater.
Yeah. How many Cinerama theaters were there? There weren't that many. There were maybe what? What do you think?
There was one. There was under 10
in the world, maybe? Under 10?
Oh, I think there were more than that, but not by much more.
Yeah. That's a good question, though.
There were definitely more IMAX theaters than there were
Oh yeah, well,
Cinerama
era.
Theaters. But there was one Cinerama theater in New York, the one that you went to.
It was called the Cinerama. Yeah.
There was one on Long Island that I remember going to. I saw It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. That when I saw it, I saw the Roadshow print. But it was not in a Cinerama theater, and it was a one projector print. And one of the things that Mr. Klawan says is that after the initial Roadshow run, they had started a showcase run.
It was
using a 35 millimeter print, which bombed, and then they brought out the 70 millimeter print into those theaters.
Right, which is what I then saw. Now I'm actually reading from Wikipedia, which, despite things, can be accurate. Three synchronized 35 millimeter projectors, 146 degrees of arc.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Introduced in the late 1950s, of course.
Right.
And this is not an article about 2001. This is an article simply about Cinerama.
It's Cinerama. And
they were used
in part by Lowell Thomas, if I'm remembering correctly.
Maybe. Are you thinking of perhaps Mike Todd?
No, not Mike Todd.
Lowell Thomas.
Mike Todd was Todd A.O.
That's right.
Mike Todd was Todd A.O.
Lowell Thomas was a radio announcer and journalist.
Yeah, yeah. And he funded Cinerama, and he actually introduced the first Cinerama film. This is Cinerama.
Yes, he did. But that's because he was the voice. I don't know how much he may have finance it. It's
no, I you have a financial stake.
Oh, okay, wait. I'm a Cinerama. Cinerama was invented by Fred Waller from 18 and languished in the laboratory for several years before Waller, joined by Harvard Buzz Reeves, brought it to the attention of Lowell Thomas, first with Mike Todd and later Marion C. Cooper. Produced a commercially viable demonstration of This Is Cinerama, which opened on Broadway September 30th, 1952. So he was involved. I don't know about financially, but if you wanted something to sound authoritative, you wanted Lowell Thomas. And the weird thing is, I started reading a biography of Lowell Thomas 2 days ago.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Synchronicity.
Just synchronicity. He was fascinating, and of course, I'll probably have to loan it to Max. But I also wasn't wrong about Mike Todd being there. But Marion C. Cooper, really? I didn't know that he was.
I knew he was involved as well. Yeah, Not sure if he directed This Is Cinerama.
Well, he was a producer mostly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that King Kong thing of his.
Yeah, that little thing.
Yeah. And also, in the world of coincidence, somewhere in one of the streaming services that I have, I think it's actually Amazon, I'm getting ready to watch the precursor of Cinerama, which was, of course, Napoleon, directed by Abel Gance, 1927.
I've never seen it.
It's.
I would like to. Yeah,
it's been restored.
Here again. Abel Gance, and he used a triptych format. He did not. He actually used it in a somewhat more creative way. It isn't that he used it in a panoramic to present a panorama, but used the separate panels to provide
different images.
Of an impressionistic combination of images.
So you might see images. Soldiers marching from the right on one image, soldiers marching from the left on another, and Napoleon in the center.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was very creative.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the history of
2001, and let me get to my point, which
yes.
I'll try to wrap it up quick so that we can move on and actually talk about the film. The fact is that here again, Klawan said, and this has always sort of tripped me up because I do remember seeing it as the Roadshow print, but it was not in a Cinerama theater, which struck me as weird because usually once you get out of Cinerama, it goes to, as Klawan calls it, the showcase print, which is you drop out. The overture, you get rid of the intermission, it just screens as a regular film. Hmm. But this was the Roadshow print, and apparently what happened was the showcase print, the quote-unquote regular ordinary print, did not do well, so they dropped that. And he said in one theater on Long Island, they brought in the 70mm print, and that had an effect. And I saw that in a theater on Long Island, so that must have been the theater.
Maybe so. The first time I saw it in the 70 mil was at Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah.
And according to what I'm reading here, it came out in Ultra Panavision 70 and Super Technorama 70.
Yeah. But in any case, this has been working up to the point that at that point in my life, I was a 12-year-old who was pretty much getting thrust into a knowledge of a world greater than the one that I had known at that point. And right at that point...
Were you already reading science fiction?
I was not reading, no. I had really not been long into following science fiction at all. I cut my teeth on science fiction with Lost in Space. But you know what?
Parker Posey, really? I said Parker Posey, really?
It wasn't Parker Posey. It was Angela Cartwright.
Well, she was there, too. You do know the reference that I'm making, right?
No, I don't.
Oh, my God. Well, within a month, Lost in Space reboot is on Netflix.
Yeah, and I know that.
And Parker Posey plays Dr. Smith.
Oh, yes, right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Just thought I'd mention.
Okay.
So, I mean,
it's got to be better than the Ack of a Goldsmith one.
Yeah.
You know, but anything could
well,
be better.
Well, I was going to say, you know, Wongo people of the
yeah.
I can't even
Women of Wongo.
Yeah. Well, you know, would be a better movie than
than the Ack of a Goldsman, Lost in Space. But in any case, I had here again. I wasn't too far into my education in science fiction at that point. It was Lost in Space and Star Trek, and then I walked into this, and you know, this was at the point where you have sort of the well, what is presented to you as a child is the standard narrative, the beginning, middle, and end, and the happy ending, and all of that. And to encounter this film that not only told a different kind of story, but told that story in a different, a completely different way, it changed me fundamentally. It changed the way I understood how stories could be told. It changed the way I looked at how film could be used to tell a story. This was probably the start of me developing a passion for film.
It may be noted that while you connected with it, and I connected with it, and I was a science fiction reader from about, well, I have, from when it was being read to me because I couldn't read yet. So I would have started at about age five.
Wow.
And because my uncle did two things for me. Number one, he introduced me to science fiction. Number two, he brought me to a radio station to answer phones during a fundraising drive in 1967. So that man had a lot to answer for. But at any rate, and he was reading to me Theodore Sturgeon. My parents got me two Bradbury books, S's for Space and R's for Rocket, because they thought with titles like that that they would be primers, mm-hmm. even though these are very adult books. But I was already familiar. I knew darn well from 2 years before I saw the movie, I knew who Arthur C. Clarke was. The person who I didn't know was Stanley Kubrick. They didn't let me see Lolita. No, I take that back. I had already seen Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I was not familiar with the concept of auteur cinema. which is a great new weight loss method, by the way. But anyway.
You are the author of your own weight.
Yes, exactly. Loss, you know. Exactly. But at any rate, so my experience was I went with my brother and parents. I don't think my uncle was with us, but we were the family group, and at least the three of them were scratching their heads saying, what in God's name was mm-hmm. that all about? And I just explained it to them. I had no problem. I understood it perfectly well. Most of the critics did not. There were two critics who were at one point or another WBAI, one by the name of Pauline Kael, who, of course, became the Pauline Kael of The New Yorker, who had the worst things to say about it. Mm-hmm. And the other one, who I never realized until I read his obit about a year and a half ago, Andrew Saris, of WBAI at that time, later of The Village Voice, who was her husband. I didn't know they were married. I just knew I read them both. And I tended to agree with her, but disagreed with her about mm-hmm. that movie. And
Pauline Kael pretty much despised the auteur theory.
Yes.
And
that may have been a lot of the reason why she didn't like the movie.
Yeah.
It was almost political for her.
Yeah.
And the on retrospect, 10 years later, I think that she rethought not the auteur theory, but I think that she rethought 2001 itself. Mm-hmm. And did like it.
By the way, for anybody who needs to know, auteur theory in summation is the idea that the director is the author.
Well, that there is
of the film, and that everything that everybody else does on the film is done to fulfill the director's vision.
Yeah, to service the director's concept. But it's not always the director. There are a few times when the auteur is a writer. It's very rare.
It's very rare.
But reading...
There have been theories advanced that the producer could be an auteur.
Right.
And in actuality, I think that is actually more true for television series.
Certainly today, very much so.
Yeah.
But and in the past, you know, without Gene Roddenberry was no director, and not necessarily a great writer, but there's no question he's the auteur of Star Trek.
Yeah.
But the auteur theory, first and foremost, said there is one person who is driving this.
Yeah.
And that goes back to Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut in, what was the name of it, Le Cahier?
Cahier du Cinéma.
Cahier du Cinéma, danke schön, which was the radical magazine that put forth that theory and caused another great science fiction film, a little bit different, Alphaville from one, mm-hmm. and Fahrenheit 451 from the other.
Yeah.
At least one of which is getting remade and released shortly. I'm sorry to say.
I think also on Netflix?
That's HBO.
I think on Netflix.
No, that's HBO.
Oh, is it HBO? Okay.
I believe it's HBO.
Okay.
And I think the casting is brilliant, and the idea that they're doing it in long-form cinema is fine, but really, the Truffaut film is just spiffy as it is.
Yeah.
And...
What wasn't as well appreciated when it came out?
No, well, 2001, Getting Back, was more or less despised. If there had been such a thing as Metacritic, I'm not a fan of Rotten Tomatoes because that's crowdsourced, but Metacritic, which assigns numbers to critical reviews of established critics and not just bloggers, some of whom are included in the Rotten Tomatoes score, the Metacritic of that day would likely have been in the 30s.
Yeah. It was not well received. And when I got to it here again, it was a few months after the fact. It was in the summer. And by the way, you know, congratulations that you were able to get your parents to see it, because I tried like hell to get my parents to see it. And my parents, being the paragons of parenthood that they were, we're always, well, of course, we'll go and see it with you this time around. Oh, look, I've got a hangnail.
If I was 13, my brother would have been 17 and very definitely into cinema. And my mother's brother, my Uncle George, a.k.a. my Uncle Wolfgang, but I never realized his name was really Wolfgang.
Why would he go to with George instead of Wolfgang?
Yeah, well, Wolfgang
is an awesome name.
She went from Liesel to Elizabeth, and he went from Wolfgang to George. My father stayed Walter in either case.
Yeah.
So, but at any rate, but German Jews had a habit of having. If they escaped, and most of my family, of course, did not, over 40 did not, those that did changed their name. But at any rate, yes, we all went. And, yeah, I had read Childhood's End, which is, I think, in its way, more important to the denouement, to the end of 2001, than The Sentinel. By the way, I haven't gotten a single guess in an email to either jim@ourwolf.com or jfreund, jfreund, @ourwolf.com on what the story was that sparked Kubrick's imagination. My source for this information...
Gee, I would have bet that you would have gotten some answer.
Yeah, even if it was wrong.
I would have bet it. That's a hint, by the way.
Yes. Well, it's a very obscure one.
But, yeah.
But
I don't want to hand it just hand it out to anybody.
And I don't want to yet. And you see, the problem is I don't want to spend this show bashing Sir Arthur. Mm-hmm. Sir Arthur did a lot of great stuff. And the movie without Arthur C. Clarke would have been not very good. Mm. He contributed a huge amount to it. What was the name of the story before? Oh, The Guardians. Okay. Mm-hmm. Before the Childhood's End can be mm-hmm. said to be a fix-up of The Guardians and one other novella, the same way that Fahrenheit 451 was an expansion of a novella called The Fireman. You can't sell a novella as a book, but you can add material to it and come up with a novel. And that happened to Childhood End. That happened to Fahrenheit 451. That happened to almost anything Raymond Chandler ever wrote, and a good deal of Philip K. Dick's work. And the
argument is made, just as a parenthetical, the argument is made, and I think it's actually right, that a novella is much better suited to adaptation as a film than a novel is.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. That's why they've had so much trouble with things until recently with, you know, the long form of television, in which what they do is they take the world building of The Handmaid's Tale or The Man in the High Castle or The Magicians. Very disappointed with the season 3 finale. Take the world, take the characters, but write their own story set in those worlds. And that works fairly well.
It works fairly well. I have a certain problem with it in that if you think of the story as being the protagonist's journey, when they do this now with series, it feels like with the protagonist's journey, the first season is the protagonist packing his bags and getting out the front door.
Yeah.
You know, so...
More or less. Heck, the first episode of The Magicians is getting...
There is a slight disadvantage to that. There is a tendency
a little bit
towards stasis.
Okay, and we have an answer. A listener came in with the right author and the wrong title. The title The Sentinel was the name of the Arthur C. Clarke story. The author, who he has absolutely correct, is Jorge Luis Borges. And you see, I can't even say his name properly.
But we do have a lovely parting gift for you. Tell him what he gets, Johnny.
He gets an Aleph for effort.
Okay, so you gave it away.
Yeah. The short story was The Aleph, which I do have a copy of it here. As I said, I dare not read the story because I would mangle just the names like Beatriz Viterbo. That's just in the first paragraph. It's not a very long story like all of Borges. It is brilliant. Borges, certainly one of the greatest writers of imaginative literature ever. Let me read the final paragraph. It's only three lines. Does the Aleph exist in the heart of a stone? Did I see it there in the cellar when I saw all things and have now forgotten it? Our minds are porous and forgetfulness seeps in. I myself am distorting and losing under the wearing away of the years the face of Beatrice. And the idea is that he sees this knowledge, he sees this person in this thing that resembles a, what's a good word for it? Oh, monolith. And Bohr has also wrote, a story, The Library. Imagine a library that contains all knowledge of all times. And he also had a story about a gateway that one can go through that takes you to these other places. Kubrick was reading this stuff while he was working on Lolita and on... Jesus, why am I blanking my favorite movie's name? On Dr. Strangelove. And I should say a favorite movie. I have many favorite movies. And the what he did, and this was Kubrick's method always, was he would start reading voraciously. He would start asking people, okay, I think all of a sudden I'm into science fiction. You know, or rather, you know, whatever it is that this Borges guy is writing, this mystical kind of stuff. And people said, well, science fiction can take you there more so than fantasy can, epic fantasy. And so Kubrick started surrounding himself with different writers and different people. I know some of this secondhand. When I spoke to both Brian Aldiss and Ian Watson about the development of the movie AI, which Kubrick was working on for, 15 years?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And Kubrick had read a story called Super Toys Last All Summer Long, which probably accounts for the first, 25% to a third of the movie that Steven Spielberg made. The question was always, was Kubrick going to produce and Spielberg direct, or vice versa? And they each were intent on the other one directing. But they were going to do the movie together. Then Kubrick died. Prematurely, as far as I'm concerned, as far as most people are concerned. And Spielberg made it, not, in my opinion, not being sure whether he should make Kubrick's film or whether he should make a Spielberg film in order to be true to the concept. At any rate, the point is that he read this Brian Aldiss story and was quite taken by that. And wanted to carry that into a certain direction. Then he hired Ian Watson, another great British science fiction writer, to spend time on his estate in England. And they would sit around and talking about philosophy. It was after a New York Review of Science Fiction reading in the very early days. We are now in our 27th season. At the time, Gordon Van Gelder was running it, and we were at his apartment after the fact, and we always went to his apartment after a reading, where we listened to Ian Watson tell his stories of how he was currently employed by Stanley Kubrick, and that he was going back, and he told these rather eccentric, fascinating stories, great for another show.
Yeah.
But what they showed was Kubrick's methodology. He did the same thing on 2001. Yes, he spoke to Arthur C. Clarke after he had done what was basically the first treatment of the film, which was called Journey to the Stars and Beyond. Now, there are so many articles that have come out this week about 2001, and many of them contradict each other. One of them says there were many people have attributed different titles, and they didn't give that one. The book, The Making of 2001 by Jerome Agel, A-G-E-L, which is very hard to get nowadays, and my copy got washed away in a flood.
I've still got my – I was trying to dig it out. I'm not exactly sure where it is. I know it's in here somewhere. My copy is literally falling apart at the spine.
It is nevertheless probably valuable.
Oh, really?
It was never reprinted.
Wow.
And it was filled – it had all the movie reviews. The ones
it had movie reviews. It had great parenthetical – stuff in it. It had an article, a quote-unquote interview with Stanley Kubrick that was titled The Territorial Imperative of Stanley Kubrick, mm-hmm. in which they had spent, I think it was something like 3 hours talking with Kubrick, and Kubrick only approved three sentences to be printed, and they filled an entire page with just one sentence. We just spent 3 hours talking with Stanley Kubrick. We just spent 3 hours talking with Stanley Kubrick. We just spent 3 hours talking about with Stanley Kubrick. I'd rather not talk about the film. We just spent 3 hours talking with Stanley Kubrick, and it just went on like
Kubrick that. Kubrick was intent on people coming up with their own idea of what the movie was about, which is why, and this is important, why he was dead set against a novel coming out. Now, Clark always...
Was he opposed to the novel?
Opposed in the form of it practically went to court and later on did go to court. As they say, you can look it up. Kubrick did not want that book coming out. But his contract with Clark allowed for it. He gave Clark co-screenplay credit, and Clark said that that entitled him. Clark
and,
claimed
and,
to be...
And I'm sorry, I had thought, and I think this is...
You're about
the,
to say
the
that Clark
that
was writing
advanced.
The novel while the movie was being shot,
yeah, exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That is the story that Clark has always told. That is the story he told when I interviewed him. That is not the story that Jerome Agel tells. And that is not, and Kubrick wouldn't discuss it. So maybe Clark was correct. But Clark has been caught in a few Clarkisms before. Clark was an amazing man. He was a genius.
He invented satellite communication.
What he did invent was the GPS.
Mm.
That's almost as good.
Yeah.
He helped develop the concept of how satellites would be used.
Yeah.
Not satellite.
I was being flippant way that Al Gore.
Yeah, but we're
invented the internet.
Yeah, but there are people who believe that. They hear such things, especially over a radio station such as WBAI in New York. Did you like the way I worked in the station break? And
right on time, too.
Actually, a minute late. But, well, okay. 2 minutes. FCC allows for 2 minutes on either side of the o'clock. But the where was I? At any rate... Clark.
We were talking about Clark and satellites.
Yes, Clark did come up with the concept and a lot of the math of how to deploy and use global positioning systems. And if not for that, you wouldn't have your Google Maps or navigation or anything like that. Yes, Clark invented that himself. He was that smart. He was that brilliant. So people really do not take away from the things that I say that Clark didn't do a lot of great stuff. However, when it came to the story of 2001, the way I got it, and I once contradicted somebody who was a film historian, but was doing it based on more current material. And I was reading, I was gobbling up every word I could get on 2001 since the day it opened 50 years and 2 days ago. And which is to say that in New York, today is the 5th. It opened on April 3rd, which, by the way, half the newspapers get wrong. They say April 2nd. Probably April 2nd was a press screening. But at any rate, Clark, no doubt, he was on the set. He was doing, as far as Kubrick was concerned, Kubrick was there to come up with, you know, the human interaction with the and the inhuman interaction with the idea of this baby at the end, this star fetus, I won't say star child, as Clark did, and he and what Clark was there for was to make the movie scientifically palatable. So, for example, in terms of the visuals, the head of visuals, Douglas Trumbull, was thrilled at the idea of Kubrick's idea that the monolith, which does very much come from the short story The Sentinel by Clark, that you go to point A, then you see the Sentinel, and that points to point B. Actually, it's C. It's on Earth, then on the Moon, and then out there. And obviously, for visual reasons, where would you put that? On the rings of Saturn. Clark vetoed it. He said, no, 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 Jupiter. It can only be Jupiter. Jupiter is a star that failed to ignite. If you want this to be a stargate, if you want this to be something that will open up, that will lead to other realms and dimensions and stuff like that, you cannot use Saturn. It doesn't have the power. Jupiter has the power. Parenthetical to that, Douglas Trumbull was very disappointed. He wanted to film a movie in the rings of Saturn, and so several years later he made...
Silent Running.
Thank you.
Of course I know that.
I knew
which
that.
Which was set around in the orbit of?
Saturn, in the rings of Saturn.
In the rings of Saturn, and had a very impressive sequence where the spaceship goes out of control into the rings
Justice
of Saturn.
Bruce Stern is going out of control, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
By the way, may I say one thing about Silent Running? Great soundtrack.
By
Peter Schickele, of course. It's the opening music for this show. It's called The Space Fleet, and it is cut to side one of Silent Running. But anyway, this is the kind of stuff that Clark was supposed to do.
Okay, but here is the thing, and this comes from what I had read in the making of Kubrick's 2001, the book. You're giving it as Clark vetoing Saturn. According to the making of Kubrick's 2001, they wanted to do Saturn. They couldn't technically create the rings around Saturn.
Trumbull insisted that he could, and he was very annoyed at the switch.
He almost quit the film. The reasoning was that in order, and I think this was fairly close to the way they explained it in the book, in order to do a convincing Saturn, they would have had to do a convincing Jupiter anyway. And so they just went with Jupiter.
Even Clark told it differently there. And certainly Douglas Trumbull told it differently. Mm-hmm. And the way it was told by Trumbull was that there was one reason why it was not feasible to do the rings of Saturn. And it can be said in one word. Budget.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah, but it was feasible in terms of Douglas Trumbull's...
Maybe in terms of technology, but the budget...
Well, he would have had to develop the technology, because they had to develop all the technology for that movie, just the same way Lucas had to develop most of his technology.
Right. But it may well be that they backward engineered a more scientific explanation for why. Or an artistic explanation.
In this particular case, I totally believed Clark's telling of the story. It makes sense. It is true. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that I once produced an astronomy program with the director of the Hayden Planetarium, long before Neil deGrasse Tyson? Yeah, no, he was never the director of the Hayden Planetarium. He's director of the Rose Planetarium.
Yeah.
But it was Mark Chartrand. And I did a show with him for about a year and a half with the very imaginative title of What's Up? But anyway...
And another parenthetical, I miss the Zeiss projector.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God, yes. And I also worked a little bit with his ex-wife, who was a cosmologist, Trudy Bell. Mark was an astronomer, and she was a cosmologist. And through them, we had Sir Arthur. And by the way, the very first broadcast satellite radio programming ever done was done at WBAI with Sir Arthur. Not by me, by Paul Wonder. So we had our connections, and I'm sticking with those. And they could be wrong. I won't swear to any of this, but it makes sense. But at any rate, the point is that more to the point, if the book was being they said no screenplay. Well, there was. There was a treatment. There wasn't a screenplay. Kubrick very often worked without screenplay, as far as I know. I don't believe there was a screenplay for Eyes Wide Shut either. It's just the way that he worked. And that's based on a book, however. Clark was probably writing a book at the time. He was not doing it at the pleasure of Stanley Kubrick. And because Kubrick wanted, everybody was going, what does the end of that movie mean? And Kubrick's answer was, what do you think it means? Yeah. And people said, oh, well, it's God. Very good. Oh, it's the next evolution of man. Very good. It's just an image that you're supposed to think of like a Salvador Dali painting. Very good. Kubrick didn't want it stated outright. Clark is coming up with the names of the apes, Moonwatcher, stuff like that. He talks about the Star Child. He talks about satellites in which there are orbiting nuclear devices and how the Star Child actually explodes the nuclear devices that are surrounding Earth in order to get rid of them, which is a very, very, very Clark story idea. Witness the movie 2010, Odyssey 2. Mm-hmm. Now, when Odyssey 2 came out, the book, Kubrick really was upset. And there was litigation of some kind. And the way it ended up is that Clark was allowed to do it on the grounds that he totally, solely owned the copyright to the book 2001, A Space Odyssey. And so Odyssey 2 was not based on the movie. It was based on Clark's own book, and he owned 100% of the rights to his own book.
Copyright law is so much fun.
It really is. and they were dealing with both English and American copyright, which makes it stranger.
This isn't quite copyright stuff, except it does sort of fall into it. But I do love the fact that at least for now, no Marvel characters in any of the Disney Marvel films can use the word mutant.
Well, that will probably no longer be true.
Yeah, and now that's...
What date is it? The first Wednesday night, Thursday morning in March. Call and ask my guest. who was my reader last night.
Oh, yeah.
At the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Chris Claremont.
Yeah.
And he's the one who can, move that decision forward. Oh, I've got to interject. And people can go to live stream or Facebook and watch last night's reading. And at intermission, we had a raffle, including an X-Men comic, a graphic novel that Chris wrote. And the audience, the mean age of the audience is about 30 years old, except for one lad who was about 9 years old. And I saw him, and I know his father's a very good science fiction writer named Robert Levy. And I asked this youngster, "So what, do you read a lot?" And he goes, "Yeah." I said, "What's your favorite book of all time?" And he said, "It's Days of Future Past." And that kid won the raffle. I could not have been bleeping happier. The fix was not in. I was just thinking, please, please let it be him. And he won it. And I said, "You go over there to Chris and you get that thing autographed and your college fund is all set."
Sometimes the universe obliges.
It certainly did last night. That's totally parenthetical.
Werner Herzog can't be correct all the time, you know.
Yeah, well, he killed Zach Penn, didn't he?
Yeah.
Or no, he didn't kill Zach Penn. He was just there when Zach Penn got killed.
Yeah.
Zach Penn. Now, what movie is it that Zach Penn just... That was in... What's the name of that film? In which Zach Penn gets killed?
Oh, I don't...
Werner Herzog film?
Ooh.
It's about the Loch Ness Monster?
The Loch Ness Monster?
Yeah.
Werner Herzog?
Yep. I'll look it up for you.
Yeah.
You've got to see this movie. It's a wonderful... Incident at Loch Ness. And written by Werner Herzog and Zach Penn. Which serves Zach Penn. It came out in 2004, directed by Zach Penn. But in investigating the Loch Ness Monster, somehow Zach Penn gets eaten. He's an exobiologist and stuff like that. Doesn't say anything about him being a movie director or writer or anything. So let's see. Oh, yes, I know what movie Zach Penn has written that's coming out shortly. Avengers Infinity War.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he got him. You know, that monster must have chopped him up fierce.
That's
everything.
Could have been like Jonah and the Whale.
Yeah, well, yeah. Do watch Incident at Loch Ness. Werner Herzog is the only survivor on board the ship. But you really don't know that it's a mockumentary. Until like three quarters of the way through the movie, you think, oh, this guy is just a nutcase trying to prove this thing about the Loch Ness Monster. And by the end of the thing, where all these living people, these people who are working today, most of them with Werner Herzog, but Zach Penn is one of the stalwart authors of I think he worked on Guardians of the Galaxy. Did you know that Chris Claremont created Star-Lord?
No kidding.
No, he told me that last night. He said it was for a different book. It wasn't for Guardians. He created Star-Lord.
Somebody else created Star-Log.
You know, my partner Barbara was an editor there. But
yeah.
But anyway, about the same time that you were at Cine Fantastique magazine.
Yeah.
About that same era. Yes, apparently Chris created that character. And he got lifted by whoever was writing Guardians of the Galaxy and dropped him in there. Happens at Marvel all the time. The same way that Chris did not create the characters in the original characters in X-Men. They were created by Stan Lee. Chris just created everybody who came in after 1968. But Wolverine was already there and so forth. Anyway, all that aside, let's get back to 2001, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that. What were we talking about again?
Clark's contribution.
Yeah.
So and I'd mentioned, since I'd mentioned Odyssey 2, and there was a movie of that, and that movie has a lot of merit to it, but it
does. When you think about the fact, and I'm not alone in this, most people said, why would you want to do a sequel to this?
Yeah.
It was a, you could,
what will it be? Something wonderful.
If you went into it understanding that it could never be 2001, that was singular and unique and a once in a millennium.
Exactly. And but that occurrence. Was, but that was the point.
If you went into 2010 understanding that, 2010 is a respectable follow-up.
But it you know what it should have been? I have my opinion on this, of course. That movie, same director, Peter Yates, same screenwriter, based on the same writer, Arthur C. Clarke, same cast, John Lithgow, Bob Balaban, Helen Mirren, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and change the name, Rendezvous with Rama.
Ooh.
Right? Why didn't they make that movie with all of the fabulous resources and all of the genius they had in the movie 2010? Why are you trying to muck up Kubrick? Make Clark.
It's the same reason that Nabisco creates 18 different types of flavors of filled cookies and calls them all Oreos, rather than giving them their own distinct names.
Yeah, but this one I think would have worked. It didn't really sell as Odyssey 2, because the fact of the matter is when I make the statement, and you often make the statement, that 2001 is the best science fiction film ever made, the vast majority of people listening to us right now don't agree.
Yeah, very true. Let me get into this, because too often you talk to people and they, 2001, it's so boring. And my answer typically is, well, you're watching it wrong.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. Number one, people, I believe all this week you have an opportunity to go in the theater and see this movie in 70mm.
Is it available in New York?
Yes, it's running in New York? Yes.
It's not in Philadelphia.
Nah.
And I tried.
I'm surprised.
I'm doing like monthly programs in the theater.
Right.
In AMC Broad Street 7, a lovely theater, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm doing monthly shows. We tried to get 2001, and it wouldn't have been the 70mm version because it's an all-digital theater. We tried to get it. Warner Brothers wouldn't let us have it.
Alas, but I've seen write-ups. I haven't seen the ads of where it's running. But I think if people in New York look it up, you should be able to. The point is, this is a big screen experience.
Mm-hmm.
With Star Wars, and when I say Star Wars, there's only one movie that was ever named Star Wars. You and I have had this conversation. People, it was renamed several years later, Episode 4, A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the name it came out under, and the original edit is better than The New Hope, and The New Hope edit is better than the digitally restored version with all the new animals in it. But the very first time you see Star Wars in a theater, you remember what theater you were in, who you were with the first time an Imperial cruiser went over your head in THX sound.
Dolby, actually.
Was it Dolby?
It was Dolby.
Huh. Yep. I thought I would have assumed. Yep, Empire would have been the first THX movie. Yes, yeah.
No,
of course.
Yeah. THX had Lucas didn't have.
He didn't have an Empire
enough weight to throw around for. Yeah, he didn't have an Empire at that point to strike back or do anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
But Star Wars, the original Star Wars, was the killer app for Dolby.
It was. It really was. But in 2001, it's the same kind of a thing. And we had this discussion when we were talking about Blade Runner 2049, where I think I appreciated more than you the experiential time that it takes for the what are they called? The spinners, those little ships in Blade Runner. It's very obvious that Villeneuve is trying to do his homage to Kubrick with those. He does a lot of homages in Blade Runner and a few in Arrival. And in 2001, there was some critic who I loathed who wrote that 2001, the ship is trying to sync up with the space station to the banal music of Johann Strauss to show us that by the year 2001, space travel will be banal. And it's like, what dork are you? You know, I'm not even, I prefer Richard over Johann.
Actually, you know what? I think what once again, you're talking about, and I had highlighted this, you're talking... I think about Stuart Klawan's again, and
I'm talking about a review that came out in 1973 or so.
Maybe not, because Stuart, and I think he makes a good point in a similar way. But go ahead,
the one I'm talking about was Putting the Movie Down. Whereas I am praising the film for that very thing, for the idea of look at the instrument panels, read them, you know, watch what the people are doing, take a look at the food, take note of the fact that when Leonard Rossiter and people are sitting in the space station not too far into the movie, it's in a Hilton. They got there on a Pan Am ship. Nobody paid for product placement. This was Kubrick saying, these things will be here. It will be like that. This is the experience of what it will be like.
There is something even more powerful to all of that. And I think there's a bit of Kubrickian wry humor in the notion of humanity reaching out into space and bringing all these things, the chain restaurants
Absolutely. And
the Hilton hotels with them, and then coming across the uncanny.
Exactly. That at the end of the movie, you're cosmic.
Yeah.
And the idea of Hilton, are you bleeping serious?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any idea of how amazing this universe is?
Yeah.
And you're talking about Pan Am? So I think you're absolutely right. You take this, you stream it on Netflix on your 40-inch screen, maybe if you're lucky. 50-inch screen with a great DLP or projection or whatever it is that you have, it's not the same
thing. It's not the same. I was talking to a manager at the theater who said, I can't stand that film. And I said to him, you're watching it wrong. You need to be in a theater. It needs to be a big screen. It needs to be a bitchin' sound system.
Yeah.
You need to be in complete darkness. Shut off the cell phone.
When the
no texting.
Famous spoiler alert, psychedelic sequence takes place near the end of the movie. It is first-person perspective for the most part, except for occasionally showing David Bowman and what's happening to his face. And it's not just awe, but fear, terror of the unimaginable, when the things that Clark calls aliens and Kubrick said are just things that are showing up on the screen, the diamonds and stuff like that. You are supposed to be in David Bowman's seat. You should see nothing else at all in your vision. Not, honey, would you bring me another Coke?
Yeah.
Or no, answering the phone.
No windows.
No texting. You know, this is this. You need to see this movie properly to understand its impact.
This is going into the experiential nature of the film, and I think this may be like really cliche, but I'm going to say it anyway. You don't really watch 2001, you live 2001.
It's true. It's absolutely true. I agree. I would have used the word experience, but I'll buy live. The thing that's, you know, if you take a look at Star Wars, which really, really, really pays off on that big screen. And I've now watched the latest film in big screen and 40-inch. But especially the first one, like I say, the first time that Imperial cruiser goes over your head. That really enhances the film, but you still get the film. You still get Blade Runner and 2049 others on a smaller screen. To name two movies off the top of my head that you must see on big screen in order to really appreciate it, otherwise you will be bored. 2001 and the other one is...
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Gravity, but I don't think that's the one you're thinking of.
No, actually, no, it's not the one I was thinking of, but I'll buy Gravity and I'll also buy Avatar, especially Avatar, which sucks if you're not watching it the right way. But no, another film of the 70s.
Film of the 70s that you need to see on a big screen. I was going to say Lawrence of Arabia, but that isn't from the 70s.
No, it isn't. And yes, that also qualifies. Barry Lyndon.
Okay.
Barry Lyndon is a movie that you can freeze frame at any moment and say, I'd like that on my wall.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a beautiful film. It's not one of my favorite Kubrick films.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a favorite Kubrick film necessarily, but it's one of the most beautifully shot films ever. And I thought, and you know, the acting is, shall we say, a bit banal. But let me ask you something. Did you see it the right way?
I did see it in a theater. I saw it. Where did I see it? I think I saw it at Cinema One.
Oh, okay. That qualifies.
Yeah.
That qualifies. Then I had a better reaction to it than you is all. Yeah. But also I enjoy Thackeray, which helps. But here, getting back to our original premise, best science fiction film ever. Period in between each word.
Yes.
One of the things that Clark said when the movie was being made, because Kubrick, he wanted to make his movie, he wanted to make his statement, he wanted it to be vast and all this, but Clark had, shall we say, stars in his eyes. And he was the one with the big, big vision who said, there has never really been a great science fiction movie. Not one that was science fiction. Now, there's Metropolis, which I would put in among my top science fiction films. But aside from the fact that it doesn't fully hold
Forbidden,
up.
Forbidden Planet is pulpy in its way.
Yes.
But great science fiction.
It's great science fiction. There are a few ways and it does not work, but that's also in my top however many. I suppose my top 5 or 10.
But in terms of true hard science fiction, there are very few films that qualify 2001.
Even to this day.
Even to this day.
And
2001 definitely, and 2001 may be the most science fiction film that has ever been made and may ever be made.
And it was made beautifully.
Yeah.
It was made beautifully.
And you know, and you're talking about Star Wars and, you know,
Star Wars isn't science fiction.
Star Wars isn't science fiction, but let me make this point, is that one of the things that I think impressed me.
And by the way, for listeners who don't know what it is, let me just say Star Wars is science fantasy.
Science fantasy. Okay. But one of the things that stuck with me about 2001 was the absolute believability of the special effects, and more to the point, the fact that the spaceships you see all seem to have mass to them.
Mm-hmm. And this,
you know, and
this is the collaboration of Clark and Douglas Trumbull.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kubrick has this vision. He has this story, he has this idea, and he wants these things. And he says, this is what I want. And he is the auteur. There's no two ways about it that this is a Kubrick film. But it is by hiring Clark and Douglas Trumbull and enabling them that he is able to get that done.
Yeah. And interesting. I mean, that traveled with Trumbull to Silent Running and Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
which is John Dykstra.
Trumbull was on Close Encounters. Trumbull did Close Encounters.
Okay, I'm gonna IMDb you on this.
No, I'm reasonably sure of that, because one of the
you
things
may be
that,
right.
that Trumbull was insistent on was the notion that spaceships could not be seen in space, and so they had to have their own external lighting, which is why the spaceships are brightly colored. In Close Encounters, it's why they have all the lights.
Well, Trumbull definitely worked on Close Encounters. I don't question that. I want to just see. Hey, Lester.
What you're thinking of with John Dykstra and Trumbull is Star Trek: The Motion Picture.
Ooh, maybe I am.
Which they both worked on.
Maybe I am. Well, I think they worked on more than a couple of things together. Okay, writing credits. Can they give 5 writing credits for Close Encounters? Really?
Everybody, I think, pitched in on Close Encounters.
Yeah, but most of them are named uncredited.
Let's see.
Produced by, music by, Vilas Zsigmond, of course, Michael Kahn casting, art direction, set direction. Oh, come on. Where's special effects, people? How can you not? Okay. Special effects by Roy Arbogast, Carlo Rimbaldi. Mm-hmm. I didn't know he worked
did,
on Close Encounters.
Carlo Rimbaldi
he
did
done the puppets.
The aliens.
Yeah. Bob Baker, Wayne Beauchamp, Johnny Borghese, Kevin Pike, Del Rium, and Robert Short. Doesn't say who was in charge. Then there's visual effects. You know what I should do is I should go and look up by the people. Mm-hmm. So let me go and
I'm fairly certain that and you could prove me wrong, but I'm fairly certain that Dykstra was not involved with Close Encounters.
Okay.
He and Trumbull did work on Star Trek, in particular.
Visual effects. Let's see. Douglas Trumbull, 2001. Candy.
Yes, that's right. I think it was a similar type of slit scan sequence for Candy.
Yeah, let's not go there. The Andromeda Strain, Silent Running, The Star Lost, Close Encounters, Special Photographic Effects, Star Trek the Motion Picture, Blade Runner.
Here again, let me just explain. When I said slit scan was the process by which they generated the psychedelic Stargate effects at the end
That's
of
right.
the film.
That's right. And mirrored them, I believe, somehow.
Yeah.
So let's see. So if I click then on his credit within Close Encounters, it doesn't take me there. Okay, so you know what? Let me also look up, in that case, Dykstra.
Dykstra.
Dykstra, I believe. There we go, John Dykstra.
Dykstra.
Yeah. Nice photograph of him.
Or,
there.
If you want, Dykstra.
Let's see.
He did work on Life Force.
Well, I didn't know Dykstra worked on Silent Running.
Oh, he did?
Yes. Then Star Wars, Battlestar Galacticus, Star Trek, some Alice Invaders from Mars, Out on a Limb, The Unholy. Something is out there. He's done a lot more work than Trumbull. Batman and Robin, Batman Forever, Stuart Little. Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, Hancock, Inglourious Bastards, X-Men First Class, Django... visual effects designer. Godzilla, Seventh Son, The Hateful Eight, seems to work for Tarantino a lot, so will probably be on the next Star Trek film. X-Men Apocalypse, Kong, Skull Island...
You don't really believe Tarantino is doing a Star Trek film, do you?
I do.
I don't.
I don't think it'll be one of his 10 films. But I believe that at the very least, he's probably has worked past tense on a treatment.
I think that is possible. I think this is as likely as Tim Burton and Nick Cage's Superman.
Well, there's that. However, with the difference being that J.J. Abrams said he is in talks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so a producer is saying he's in talks with Tarantino. That's all he's saying.
Yeah.
He's not saying any more than that. So that's a far way from saying anything has been greenlighted or anything like that. But Tarantino has certainly had ideas about it, and he has been talking about it. And that may be enough to say, okay, we would like you to write a treatment. Or at the very least, he may get a thanks.
I think we can slot this into as more proof to the argument that we are actually living in a simulation that's going wrong.
Could be. I mean, Tarantino's a very surprising guy. I've seen him
No doubt.
I have seen him act on Broadway. I saw the play Wait Until Dark the original with Lee Remick and Robert Duvall. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. I'm a big fan of the original film, with the exception of Ephraim Zimbalist being in there. And they wrote original lines for him that are not in the play. But then I saw a revival of the show with Marisa Tomei and Quentin Tarantino.
Where he played probably the drug dealer.
Well, there's only one major role in there.
Yeah.
And
so,
that's Harry Rote, the one that Alan Arkin won his Academy Award for.
I could see where probably he did a hell of a job.
He was fabulous. But mind you, we're talking on stage.
Yeah.
And that's the point, as you would say, and how would Tarantino be as an actor on Broadway? Come on! He was great.
Yeah.
And all I'm saying is, you know that I'm not a big... Well, I love his writing. I don't love his... the visceral end of his visuals, okay? I will probably never see Hateful Eight. I have seen Pulp Fiction. Tarantino did an R-rated cut for television, and that I have seen. And even that I thought was a bit strong. But I thought the writing of it, the time looping, was genius. So I don't underestimate him. Having said that,
did you find Dykstra on Close Encounters?
No.
Yeah. And I walk away undefeated.
Okay. Yeah. He's done a whole lot of films. And TV things you would never have guessed.
For sure he has.
And I wouldn't
say
I would,
more than Doug Trumbull, but Doug Trumbull has invested most of his time into trying to advance film technology in various and sundry ways.
Yes, absolutely. As opposed to, I mean, he's only directed three films.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name of the one in which Natalie Wood died. Brain something.
Brain scan.
That's it.
Brain scan?
Something
Brainstorm.
Like that.
Brainstorm.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Cliff Robertson and Natalie Wood.
Yeah.
And
which was originally supposed to be the showcase for his show scan.
Well, exactly. He's, as you say, he's far more interested in the technologies than he is into just making a movie. And he's not a great movie director. Silent Running.
Yeah.
Which, you know.
But the interesting thing about Silent Running and bringing it back to 2001, one of the reasons why he did Silent Running was that while, you know, he was, you know, impressed with the visuals of the film, he said the film had no heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's
which I don't particularly agree with.
Now, I'll tell you who, there are a lot of great filmmakers who agree with that. And here's another story about 2001 that is really important, is how copied it is. And I don't just mean... I mean, there was a decade in which you could not hear a TV commercial without hearing Also Sprach Zarathustra, the Portsmouth Sinfonia.
You still do.
Let me tell a story now.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
The point is how influential it is. Not just Space Oddity, not just this, not that, not just that. Many people have referred to Kubrick as the coldest of filmmakers. Maybe not the coldest ever, but he's very cold. And he certainly is. I don't hold that against him. 2001 is certainly a cold movie. It is not a movie about warm human beings. Neither is Dr. Strangelove. Neither is Lolita. Neither is Clockwork Orange, etc., etc. One of the great movie directors of all time, Andrei Tarkovsky, got dreadfully upset over 2001 and wrote articles and did interviews, which are available in the DVD extras of Solaris. And here's an interesting point. Tarkovsky made Solaris with Kubrick in mind. He said, I will show you a science fiction film that's real science fiction that takes place in outer space, and the humanity is hot. that the people are warm, that it's all about the people. And I will show you, Stanley, that it can be done. I don't know that the two ever met or corresponded, but they corresponded in terms of at least Tarkovsky making films in response to his reaction to Kubrick. And Solaris, which I think, which is again in one of my top science fiction films. Do you like it?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact.
Solaris is, you can see very well as he's making that. He does the whole experiential thing. He does it in Moscow. He does it in the scene where the psychiatrist, Chris Watts's name, is going to the spaceport. And he's showing you almost the entire trip. He spends like 11 minutes going from his house to the spaceport. We don't even get to see the rocket take off. It's about that experience. And then, next thing we know, he's over the planet or over the ocean, Solaris. He spends great deals of time doing that same kind of experiential cinema, but he spends a great deal of time with that experience of just people dealing with the situation they are in. Again, not a lot of verbiage in there. He uses a lot of the technique. He uses a lot of what the cinema. He's in the same realm of cinema as Kubrick, but he absolutely he was doing it as an angry response.
I wouldn't argue that Kubrick is definitely very precise and I guess you could say cold filmmaker. I would counter though that there is a tremendous amount of optimism in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
The entire idea of the film is that humanity stands on the precipice of a greater understanding of the universe, mm-hmm. that there is something greater waiting for humanity than just Howard Johnson's and Hilton hotels.
That's right. No, we're not saying that he isn't optimistic. We're saying that his filmmaking is very cold. That yeah. You are watching when you talk about the trip from the station on Luna going to the dig where they have come up with the monolith, mm-hmm. and again, no conversation mm-hmm. during that entire sequence, and the Ligeti music in the background, you can probably name only one character out of the seven or eight.
That's true. That's true. They are.
And that one character is so incidental that he can be replaced by Roy Scheider. and nobody will know the difference. It's Twoo. another movie reference.
And on that note,
let
me just throw in that for all the anonymity and for all the fact that they are, you know, that they are encased in these machines that allow them to survive on the surface of the moon. One of the most stunning things about the sequence is the very human thing that Dr. Floyd does with mm-hmm. the monolith. You know,
yeah,
there is humanity there still.
Yes, but it's almost in groups. It's humanity, it's not people. Mm. And I think that Kubrick wanted it that way. And I think that, and we won't discuss Stanislaw Lem because he hated both movies based on Solaris. so he doesn't count. But sorry, I'm typing something here at the same time.
Can I ask you something? Because this is something that I do, and I will make note of it in my reviews, is a tendency to find visual parallels in science fiction films, present-day science fiction films, with 2001. So to the point that in the film The Arrival, the formatting of the aperture...
Just Arrival, which, not The Arrival, but go on.
Arrival, okay. Arrival, the formatting of the aperture into the spaceship reminded me similarly of the aperture that the Pan Am commuter jet approaches.
I don't think I haven't seen Sicario or Passengers, but I think it's very, very likely that Villeneuve doesn't not think about Kubrick a whole lot.
You know, there were also the obvious parallels. Interstellar, very obviously.
Yes, yes, very obviously. There are all kinds of visual homage, especially in Villeneuve's films,
Here's the thing, is that I see it all over the place, and I don't know if that's me or if it's the filmmakers
but,
actually
but you know
doing
what? You see a lot of that even in, in films that refer to Metropolis. And that starts with and includes Blade Runner. Mm. Very much so.
Yeah, very true.
And its sequel, Villeneuve certainly... accepts that and runs with it.
By the way, Blade Runner, special effects?
Yep.
Doug Trump.
Yes. No, that I knew. So, very quickly, because we have a minute and a half left, a movie I recommend to you that you haven't mentioned. A wonderful... I guess you would call it fantasy film. Currently playing, opens in the last 2 weeks. Don't miss Isle of Dogs.
Oh, I want to see that.
See it on the big screen. See, because the director, Wes Anderson, fills the screen with little references to so many other movies, in one junk pile, and if you watch that on a small screen, you're not going to catch it. It is a warm, funny, wonderful.
I'm hearing
movie.
A lot about this.
This is a wonderful movie. That Avengers thing, you can get to it eventually. Go see Isle of Dogs. Just saying.
There you go. I thought I was the movie reviewer here.
You are.
Yeah, but I've been shirking my responsibility. I will grant you that. But
yeah. Well, do you have anything lined up for next week?
I am going to try. I think my workload has lightened up that I may get something. I was actually thinking of getting to A Quiet Place, which I am really eager.
Sounds interesting
to see.
Not the first film on my list, but it should be the first film on the list of many listeners.
Yeah.
Our time is up.
Okay. Can I throw in one thing quickly?
Yes.
April 18th in Philadelphia at the AMC Broad Street 7, Attack of the Classics, we will be screening Blade 2.
Oh, God. Okay.
The greatest
now, who directed that one?
Martial arts body horror film ever directed by an Oscar-winning director.
And the director was?
Guillermo del Toro.
Of course. Of course. And I'm so pleased that he won this year.
Yeah.
It's about bleeping time that genre cinema got the respect that del Toro got. Bearing in mind that 2001 was nominated for what? Visual effects, nothing else, I think.
No, it was actually nominated. I was just reading this. It was actually nominated for a number of awards. Special effects was the only one it won.
Oh,
and
okay.
There was a lot of controversy about the fact that
but our time existed. Our time is up.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan Persons.
This was fun.
Yes, it was. We needed another 3 hours, but it was a good It was a good overview. Okay, thanks. Take care. Have a good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, I'm not sure what I'm doing. I will be probably returning to a Facebook Live event, but I'm going to have new rules for Facebook Live. I'll talk about it. Well, as a matter of fact, on Facebook, I'm going to post about it and ask your opinions. So join us at that time. In a few weeks, our guest will be Chris Claremont. So get ready for that. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way. And don't forget, become a BAI buddy. Oh, and everybody, be good to each other.
I'm not on a slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America. Home the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Can't hold my tongue, we just let it blow. So help me to